Okay, good morning, everybody. Bio 231. It's November 16th. And we started respiratory system last time. And let's see, practicums are going on this week. Okay, this is going to be on the test. It got a little bit quieter, but not all that much quieter. Okay, you guys, listen up, because I'm going to run out of voice. If you got an important conversation going on, just take it out in the hallway, okay? All right, so last time we talked about the upper respiratory system and lower respiratory system. So upper is the oral cavity, nasal cavity, and the pharynxes. There are three pharynxes, right? Here's the nasal pharynx, oral pharynx is behind the oral cavity. Laryngopharynx is behind the larynx. And right at the larynx, that begins what? Begins the lower respiratory tract. Let's see, let me get some of these lights off. Like that, there we go. All right, so the larynx, make sure you know the laryngeal cartilages, and then just below the larynx, right, distal to the larynx, you have the trachea, and then what do the airways become after the trachea bifurcates? Trachea bifurcates, going to right and left lung, bifurcates to form primary bronchus, right? Primary main bronchus. I don't have that on the slide, but I'm sure I could find it pretty quickly. Okay, so here's the trachea, then here is left main bronchus, here's the right main bronchus over here. And then you get, after the next bifurcation, that's a secondary, and then after the next one, that would be a tertiary bronchus until it gets smaller and smaller and smaller. All right, so don't forget, the right lung is bigger than the left lung. Why is that? Because the heart takes up some space, right, in the mediastinum, and so that decreases the size of the left lung compared to the right lung. Also, notice that the size of the primary bronchi are different as well. You cannot notice because that projector turned off or was not ever on. Aye, aye, aye. Let's do this. I thought it was on. Yeah, there's a sign-in sheet coming from the top down. Okay, what happened to projector one? It just died. It was on, right? It wasn't on? I thought I had it on.
I didn't see it on when the teacher was here.
Oh, okay. Maybe it's not okay. Well, we can deal with that because I can slide this over to here. Okay, so here's the trachea. After the bifurcation, you got the main bronchi or primary bronchi. Notice that the right main bronchus is bigger than the left. And does that make sense? Sure, because the left lung is smaller than the right, so that airway doesn't have to be quite as big. All right, and also because of the heart, the angle of the left main bronchus is a little bit steeper, right? So that, for instance, if somebody does inhale some kind of food, chances are it's going to go into the right side of the thoracic cavity. It's going to go into the right lung as opposed to the left lung because it's a bigger tube and it's a straighter shot down in there. And remember, that's the last recourse you have if somebody has an obstructed trachea. And if you can't remove that foreign body by doing a Heimlich maneuver, then what's your last option? Yeah, positive pressure, try to force that object down into either one lung or the other so that when they breathe, they at least have half of their lungs working for them. Okay, that's better than expiring completely. Okay, so in the respiratory zone, we have bronchioles. So these airways get smaller and smaller and smaller. And bronchioles do not contain cartilage. All right, so these things can collapse, but they do have smooth muscle that can constrict and reduce airflow. So here is a terminal bronchiole, and I don't see any cartilage. I see respiratory bronchioles, and respiratory bronchioles have these little pockets on them. These little pockets we call alveoli, and this is where gas exchange actually takes place within an alveolus. And then as we go further distally into the lungs, then we see that there's a group of alveoli right here, and we call that an alveolar sac. And on these alveolar, on each alveolus, you see that there's a network of structures that surround them. One of the networks is going to be capillaries, right? That's where exchange takes place. So these alveoli fill up with air, and that exchanges with the capillary that surrounds them. But also around these alveolus, there's a network of elastic tissues. So these alveoli can expand when you inhale, and then when you relax, guess what happens to an alveolus? It shrinks back down, and when it shrinks back down, it aids in what process? Expiration, expiring air out of your lungs. So that when people have degeneration of these elastic tissues around the lungs, they have trouble exhaling, which doesn't seem like much of a problem, but why is exhalation important? Yeah, because if you can't exhale, then you can't inhale to get new fresh air into your lungs. So that these elastic properties of the lungs are very, very important. Okay, so here is, all right, just a zoomed in region, and something that equalizes the pressure right between these different alveoli so that they all inflate our alveolar pores. Okay, so here you can see the capillary network around every alveolus. And in your body, you have about 300 million alveoli, and that's the site of exchange of gases. Okay, so here is the arterial supply. It's blue colored, and then the venous return back to the heart is red colored, obviously because of exchange that's taking place in the lungs. All right, so let's zoom into a particular alveolus right here. We see that the shape, right, of an alveolus, of these cells that make up an alveolus, what's the shape of these cells that make up an alveolus right here? Do they look columnar or cuboidal? No, they look flat, right? So that's just a simple squamous epithelium that makes an alveolus up. And that particular shape is specialized for exchange because it's thin, right? So that material can move across that particular membrane. All right, so that's what we call a type 1 cell. There's a type 2 cell right here, and I see another type 2 cell right here. All right, and that has to do with the nature of water. Okay, and water is actually a sticky kind of compound, right? It's not slippery like oil. And so there is water on the inside of an alveolus, and because water is sticky, if an alveolus were to collapse and the walls across the alveolus were to touch each other, then they wouldn't be able to inflate. And that happens to a lot of people, especially newborn babies, for instance. They can't inflate their lungs because the alveolar type 2 cells that I see right here aren't functioning. And it's the job of this alveolar type 2 cell to secrete a compound that breaks the surface tension of water, right? And it's kind of like a little oily substance. It's very, very slippery, right? And so that surfactant, that just stands for surface active agent, reduces the surface tension and allows this alveoli to inflate so that air can enter an alveolus so that it can exchange with the capillary that's nearby right here. So people that don't produce surfactant are at a way reduced pulmonary function. They have to be put into an incubator, for instance, with a high oxygen concentration, which helps the diffusion of oxygen into the capillaries. All right, so there is a concept of the respiratory membrane. And I'm going to modify that a little bit compared to what's in your book. And even, I think, at the end of chapter questions or the online questions, it doesn't mention one thing, right? But I'll be sure to mention it. The first lining inside the alveolus right here, remember, is a watery environment, and there's that chemical that defeats surface tension, right? That's really the first part of the respiratory membrane, right? So it's this layer of surfactant that lines every alveolus. And what's the function of that surfactant? What does it allow this alveolus to do? That's important that you have that kind of on the tip of your tongue. What does surfactant allow this alveolus to do? To inflate so that actually air can get in that's going to allow for exchange. All right, so maybe just make a little drawing, like a little squiggly line right there. That's a layer of surfactant. All right, the next layer is the wall of the alveolus. right, which makes up the second part of the respiratory membrane. Then there's a very, very, very thin interstitial space, right, loose connective tissue, which glues the wall of the alveolus up against the wall of a capillary. And then what can you tell me about a capillary? How thick is a capillary? Very thin. It only has the endothelium, which again is what? Just a simple squamous epithelium. That enhances exchange. All right, so that's the respiratory membrane. Number one, a layer of surfactant. Number two, the wall of the alveolus. Then it's very thin interstitial space. And then the fourth part is the wall of the capillary. And that's very thin. Even if you were to add all those layers together, that's still a very thin membrane, which allows for exchange of oxygen leaving the alveolus going into the blood and CO2 that's in the blood leaving going into the alveolus to be exhaled. So don't forget about that little layer of surfactant right there. And you should also know what kind of cell is secreting surfactant. Yeah, it's the type 2. All right, there's another cell, right, that I didn't mention. Okay, it's these right here. These are the little shapeshifter cells. These are white blood cells, and these are called monocytes when they're in the blood, but they can crawl out of the blood because remember, some capillaries have big spaces between the cells, and they crawl around looking for dust particles and bacteria and viruses, and they phagocytize those particles and bring them to a lymph node, and then it trains the immune system to identify those bacteria to develop antibodies or contact killing capability with T lymphocytes. All right, so that's their job, is to clean those very microscopic small spaces of lungs out so that you can fight infection, because we're always continuously breathing in bacteria and viruses, right? Okay, so the shape of the alveolus is important. It allows for exchange. It maximizes the surface area for exchange. Okay, and let's see. Do I have a little figure of merit right here? Pleural cavities. Okay, gas exchange, about 300 million alveoli. All right, so this alveolus, think of it as a grape. And a grape you can peel the skin off of. Right, so I have a bunch of grapes and you can peel the skin off. And then take the skin and lay it down flat on a table. Right? And in your lungs, you can do that as well. You could peel all of the alveoli out and take the walls of the alveoli and put all next together, lay it flat on a tabletop. Okay? And I want you to understand something about surface area for exchange. Like, for instance, this piece of paper right here. What's the surface area? How would you calculate the surface area of this piece of paper? It would be the height, right, times the width of this piece of paper, right? So this would be what? 11 times 8.5. Who's got a calculator? Calculate that out. I can't do that in my mind. 98.5? Something like that? Okay, whatever it is. All right, that's the surface area. What's the surface area of this table? It's bigger, right? It's a lot bigger. We'd have to measure it, but we could measure it because look what I got. I've got a ruler. But actually, I have something else that we can measure the surface area of, and this doorway right here. How do we measure the surface area of this doorway? Measure the width? Oh, look at the width. It's exactly 1 meter. That's nice. All right, and now what about the height? Just use the ruler once again. So here is 1 meter, and then here is exactly 2 meters. That's really handy, because then what's the surface area of this door? It's going to be 1 times 2, right? So it would be 2 square meters. Is the surface area of this door right here. And why is this door right here? It allows for exchange in and out of the room, right? So whenever you think of surface area, I want you to think of it as what? A doorway for exchange. And as this doorway gets bigger, what happens to exchange? Does it go up or down? Okay, so think of a garage door that your car drives through. It's a lot bigger than this, right? How many people can get through this small doorway at one time? Maybe 2, 3. What about a big garage door that your car goes through? I don't know, maybe 20, 30 people can go across at one particular time. So as the surface area for exchange gets bigger, right, then more things can go across it. So think of it as a doorway. So So if we were to peel all of the alveoli, lay it flat on a piece of paper, on a tabletop like that, what would be the surface area? All right, your thoracic cavity is pretty small, right? But the surface area would be 70 square meters. So how many of those doorways right there? That was two, okay? So that would be what? And like 35 of those doorways put together make the surface area inside your lungs for exchange. That's huge. That's about half of a tennis court right there. I don't know where these blue lines are coming from. All right, so it's kind of interesting that evolution has figured out a way to put this huge surface area for exchange so that oxygen has an easy way of getting into your body and CO2 has an easy way to get out. But evolution has figured out a way to, what, convolute it so that it fits inside your thoracic cavity. And, you know, personally, I like that a lot because I don't see why I would like to be as wide as a tennis court and half as tall just to put my lungs in there. Okay, so that's really very, very nice. All right, so don't forget about the respiratory membrane. It's what, the layer of surfactant, the wall of the alveolus, that interstitial space that's really small, and then the wall of a capillary. Okay, so when you think of surface area for exchange in everyday language, what will you be thinking of? The function would be exchange, but what's the structure, the everyday structure that you use all the time when you think of surface area? Immediately, I just want you to think of, what's that over there? Yeah, it's a doorway. Just think of doorway. Okay, cavities around the lungs. Your lungs are on the outside, are not open to the outside world. The inside is open to the outside world, so there's a mucous membrane on the inside of the lungs. All right, but what about the outside? The outside's not open to the outside world. What do we call a membrane that's not open to the outside world? A serous membrane. Okay, that's a serous membrane. Maybe I have a picture of a serous membrane right here. Yeah, that's not too bad. And how many divisions or how many parts does a serous membrane have? It's got three main parts, right? So there's the part of the membrane that's right on the surface of the lungs right here. And the membrane is going to be called the pleural membrane because it surrounds the lungs. The division that's right on the surface is going to be called the visceral pleura, right? And then that same membrane, as we trace it around right here, right, it's continuous, but then it forms kind of like another flap and it lines the surface of the thoracic cavity, right? And so that's what we call the parietal division of the pleura. So this would be the parietal pleura. Here's the visceral pleura. And guess what we have separating them? The serous cavities fill with serous fluid. All right, now the fluid inside the lungs is loaded with surfactant so that it's not sticky. But the serous fluid right here is more like water, so it is sticky. So it acts like a glue. It glues the wall of the lungs, right, this exterior wall, or glues the visceral pleura to the parietal pleura right here, so that when you change the dimensions of your thoracic cavity, right, the lungs get bigger or smaller as well, right, because they're glued together because of that serous fluid. So think of these two different fluids as being drastically different. You have surfactant on the inside of the lungs so that it can inflate, but the fluid in the serous cavity is very sticky so that it can pull on the lungs when the size of the thoracic cavity changes. Thank you. Okay, so these are the divisions of the pleural cavities that you should know. So the lungs are lined with a serous membrane called the pleural membrane, pleural cavities. All right, let's talk about mechanics of breathing. There are pressure and volume changes. What am I missing back there? I feel left out. What do you got? Nothing too important? Okay, so let's talk about the mechanics of breathing. It means that the size of your thoracic cavity is going to change. And there is an inverse relationship to volume and pressure, right? Inverse relationship. So that means that when the volume increases of your thoracic cavity, if the volume increases, what happens to pressure if it's an inverse relationship? It goes down, right? And if the volume of the thoracic cavity goes down, what happens to pressure? It goes up, right? So that explains, right, how we move air in and out of our lungs. Because fluid, like air or liquid, moves because of a pressure gradient. In order for fluid to move from one place to another, right, fluid has to go from an area of high pressure to an area of low pressure, right? So in order for you to inhale, the pressure inside your thoracic cavity has to decrease below atmospheric pressure. How can you get the pressure inside your thoracic cavity to decrease? You decrease the pressure by increasing the volume, making the volume of the thoracic cavity bigger, okay? And we can do that with muscles. And in particular, all right, the diaphragm is the most important muscle for inspiration. Now, on the slides that you see right here, there are two different kinds of breathing. There's quiet breathing, like what you're doing right now, and then forced breathing when you're hyperventilating, like when you're undergoing some kind of exercise. All right, so let's take a look at this picture, that picture. What about this one? Okay, I think this is the best picture that we have. All right, when you're not breathing, the diaphragm has this dome shape to it when the diaphragm is relaxed. And when it contracts, right, then the distance of the length of this muscle shortens, right? So when it shortens, it gets pulled down. So can you see the diaphragm nice and flat right here? All right, so when the diaphragm contracts, what I'm circling right here is the additional volume that the lungs have, or the thoracic cavity has. And as the volume increases, what happens to pressure? Remember, it's an inverse relationship. So as the volume increases when the diaphragm contracts, right, then the pressure inside the lungs decreases. And the pressure in the air stays the same, so air runs into the lungs as a result. So it goes from high pressure to low pressure. So that's how the lungs are inflated during quiet breathing. And then to exhale, all we have to do is relax the diaphragm. The diaphragm has elastic properties. It goes back to its original location. So it forces, right, it forces the size of the thoracic cavity to decrease, right? And when the volume of the thoracic cavity decreases, the pressure increases. So air flows from high pressure inside the lungs to low pressure in the atmosphere. All right, so that's how we exhale. Now don't forget what else happens. Don't forget around the alveolus is additional elastic tissue. All right, so that also helps force air out of the lungs. So inspiration is active because it requires the contraction of the diaphragm. But here's the interesting thing. During quiet breathing, like what you're doing right now, you just have to relax, and that causes expiration. So during quiet breathing, okay, contraction of the diaphragm causes inspiration, but for expiration, quiet breathing is passive. It's just due to the elastic properties of the alveolus and elastic properties of the diaphragm. All right, now forced breathing is a little bit different, right? For sure the diaphragm has to contract for inspiration, but there can be other muscles that play, like the pectoralis major, external intercostals, even the sternocleidomastoid and serratus anterior. These elevate the sternum and elevate the rib cage. So not only does the thoracic cavity get bigger because the diaphragm contracts, but because of contraction of these other muscles, it causes the rib cage to expand laterally, and it causes the rib cage to expand anteriorly as well. So there's a big change in volume due to these skeletal muscles when they contract. And as the volume of the thoracic cavity increases, what happens to the pressure once again? The pressure decreases, air flows into the lungs. All right, so that's what happens during forced inspiration. And forced expiration, we can't just rely on passive properties because it's not fast enough. We need to contract some muscles. The muscles that we contract to decrease thoracic volume are the internal intercostals and all of the abdominal muscles, like the rectus abdominis and the oblique and then the internal, right, and transverse abdominis muscles. compress the abdominal contents, like your intestines, up into the thoracic cavity, decreasing the volume, increasing the pressure, and that helps with expiration. All right, so there's two major ways that we breathe. One is quiet breathing, and the other is forced breathing. And probably the most interesting is, for expiration, quiet breathing is a completely passive process because of all the elastic tissues that you have in your body. Okay. All right, I'm going to talk about some of these things right here, but not everything. What controls respiration, right? You can hold your breath. And we should do this. One of these semesters, we're going to do this. All right, we're just going to hold our breath. And since the diaphragm is skeletal muscle, it's under voluntary control. And you can hold your breath so long that what will happen? You pass out, okay? But I don't want to do that today because none of us are wearing helmets. And I don't want you to bonk your head on the tabletop and in the chair and then bounce your head off the floor. But that can happen. As a matter of fact, you might even have a child that does that when they're really mad at you and want to freak you out. Oh, and some people are laughing and smiling because you're probably remembering a time when you did that to your parents, right? Okay. I didn't do that to my parents. But that's not such a big deal because after you pass out, what happens? You just automatically start breathing again, right? So you have some automatic functions that take over. And the part of the brain that controls that is the respiratory center. And the respiratory center is partly in the pons and partly the medulla, right? So that's the respiratory center. And there are some nuclei in these parts of the brain that act like a pacemaker that automatically adjusts the rhythm of breathing, and then these other nuclei make sure that you don't overinflate your lungs because your lungs are very delicate tissue, and you can definitely overinflate and rip lung tissue when that happens. So you have some nuclei that inhibit inspiration to protect your lungs. But you should at least know where the respiratory center is. It's in the pons and the medulla. And that automatically can adjust the rate, okay, and depth of breathing. And you can override that, of course, with your conscious thought. Now, the nerve that goes from the respiratory center all the way to the diaphragm, and you had to know this, I think, for peripheral nervous system. That could even be on the test on Monday, right? Don't forget you have a lecture test on Monday, right? That's the phrenic nerve. And the origin of the phrenic nerve is the cervical region. As a matter of fact, it's C3 through C5, and then it goes through the cervical plexus. Right, and remember the beauty of a plexus is that it allows alternate routes for important nerve impulses to get to a vital organ, for instance, like the diaphragm. And why is the diaphragm a vital organ? Why can't you live without a functioning diaphragm, without a lot of technical assistance? Because it allows you to breathe, right? That's the major muscle for inspiration. All right, so unless someone's going to breathe for you through mouth-to-mouth resuscitation, all right, if your diaphragm isn't being controlled, then you need to be on a respirator. So what are some things that control respiration? In the respiratory center, there are chemoreceptors, and chemoreceptors measure chemicals that are inside your body. And you got a couple different regions for chemoreceptors. There's a central chemoreceptor region and peripheral receptors. The central receptors are located in the medulla and the pons. They're sensitive to small changes in CO2 and pH. Now, why might that be really kind of interesting and kind of startling to some people? When I first started studying physiology, I would have not guessed CO2 or pH, which is the acid content of your body, but what would make perfect sense to regulate respiration? The amount of oxygen that's in your blood, right? But that's not the case, okay? It's really CO2 because CO2 influences pH, and pH influences all of the chemical reactions that are taking place in your body. So, right? So it's really a good idea that CO2 is monitored and pH is monitored before oxygen is. And as a matter of fact, okay, when people design ventilation for buildings, that's exactly what they build into the physical apparatus for monitoring air quality inside a building. It's the CO2, not the oxygen content. All right, so an increase in CO2 or a decrease in pH, as a matter of fact, these things are linked together. When CO2 builds up in your body becomes much more acidic, and that will stimulate ventilation. That will cause you to start breathing. All right, so just by holding your breath, That will do what? That will stimulate the respiratory center. Hold your breath, and what will you notice? An urgency to breathe, an urgency to ventilate to get rid of that CO2. Right? And if you want to decrease this sense to breathe, what can you do to decrease that urge to breathe? And people do this as a kid. You would, if you were at a swimming pool, you could say, well, I can swim underwater 3 or 4 times. I bet you can only do it like 1.5 times. And then you'd see who could hold their breath longer. But what is a way that you can hold your breath for a really long time? You can hyperventilate. And as you hyperventilate, you get a lot of, you get rid of a lot of CO2 in your body that's building up, right? So that after that hyperventilation, you can hold your breath for a much longer period of time as a result. Okay, so hyperventilation gets rid of CO2, so you can hold your breath for a longer period of time without having that urgency to breathe. And people that are free divers that like to go fishing out in the ocean without scuba tanks, right? They hyperventilate before they dive down and go spearfishing, right? So they can swim underwater for a long period of time without that urge to breathe, which is really handy if you're underwater. But what else is happening? If they're exercising underwater, they don't have an urgency to breathe because there's no CO2 built up in their body, but what is being used up? Even though they don't have an urgency to breathe, what is being used up in their bodies? Oxygen, nonetheless, is still being used up, and if they use up so much oxygen before getting that urgency to breathe, guess what? You can lose consciousness because you can't maintain brain function. And if you're underwater, okay, and you pass out, because you're holding your breath consciously that whole time, what's going to take over as soon as you pass out? The respiratory center is going to cause you to breathe. But if you're underwater, what good is that? Right? That's really bad. Right? You're just going to die as a result of that. So those free divers do have to be careful that, right, that they don't hold their breath for so long that they pass out underwater, and that would be the end of them. Okay. So there are peripheral receptors. Right, and the peripheral receptors are in the carotid sinus and the arch of the aorta. Where's the arch of the aorta at? Yeah, you know where that is. Now, where's that carotid sinus? Your book doesn't make a big deal of it, but it's at the bifurcation, right, of the common carotid and where the internal and external, right, branch off of it. So you have special chemoreceptors there that are sensitive to changes in oxygen, but only huge changes, only if there's a drastic reduction in oxygen do these receptors send signals to the respiratory center saying to increase ventilation. Okay, so this is like the last resort. Okay, but higher centers can control ventilation as well, like the cerebral cortex, because the diaphragm is a skeletal muscle. It's under voluntary control. So maybe you're a singer, right? You take a deep breath and then slowly let out that air to sustain singing. Hypothalamus, right, is pretty close to the respiratory center, and so the hypothalamus relays emotional stimuli to the respiratory center. So, for instance, if you hear some really startling bad news, what's one of the first things people will do? They will gasp. They'll go like that because the hypothalamus is connected to the respiratory center. All right, proprioceptors. Who can remember where proprioceptors are at? They measure tension in muscles, and they measure angulation of joints. So even with your eyes closed, you know a lot about your body position. You know what your joints are doing and where your extremities are through these proprioceptors. And whenever proprioceptors are stimulated, right, they will stimulate the respiratory center for ventilation so that you can hyperventilate. So right now you're sitting down, you're not exercising, but you could move your knee joint and your hip joint by moving your legs around underneath you. I really wouldn't call that exercise. Would you call that exercise? Just kind of just move your legs around a little bit. You're not going to start sweating. But you will notice you will start breathing heavier, right? Your ventilatory rate will increase because these proprioceptors right here will sense that motion and send action potentials or electrical activity to the respiratory center, which will increase respiration. Right, and other receptors can stimulate respiration, like touch, pain, and temperature. Right, what do you think would happen if I took an ice cube and without you noticing it, I put it on your back? Okay, so that's part touch, right? That would startle you. That's temperature, probably not a very pleasurable kind of stimulus, so you could consider that pain as well. That's going to increase respiratory rate is the same way. All right, so when people feel cold, that stimulates the gasp reflex. And I think of a kind of an interesting story with this gasp reflex. A number of years ago, there are a bunch of people that went out on a boat in Marina del Rey in the harbor for a Christmas party. And it was just a bunch of people from work that were having a Christmas party. And have you ever heard of the hornblower yachts? Okay, so you can rent them out for weddings and for different kinds of occasions, and they serve supper. But these really aren't ocean-going boats. They just stay in a harbor and kind of putt around inside the harbor. But it's kind of fun because you can see Christmas lights in the evening, that kind of thing. Well, anyway, in Marina del Rey, one of these hornblower yachts was out in the harbor, away from the dock, and it caught on fire. And it didn't have to have lifeboats because it wasn't designed to go out on the ocean. And so they had about 100 people on board, not enough boats in the harbor to evacuate everybody from this boat that was burning down. So the captain told them to jump overboard. So there you are with your nice tuxedo and evening gown, and somebody tells you to jump out in the complete darkness, right, to jump into the harbor. So you can imagine what that's like, right? Terrible thing. Right, and so when people jump into the water, what's the temperature of the ocean water around here? Is it nice and comfortable like bath water? No, it's not freezing cold, but when you jump in, right from having dinner, right, or cocktails, it's going to feel like freezing. And when you jump underwater, guess what's going to be produced? A gasp reflex. So as soon as you hit that water, you're going to go, and if your head's underwater, then of course you have a really high percentage that you're going to drown. And I was just amazed that nobody drowned. Okay, because they jumped into the ocean. But fortunately, they didn't have lifeboats, but fortunately what they did have was life preservers. And there were enough people on board to get everybody, even though they had all these fancy tuxedos and things on, they put a life preserver on and jumped overboard, and nobody drowned because when they jumped overboard, their head was held above the water when they went through that really cold water, and then they were able to swim to a dock and get out. Okay, so just kind of be aware of that. If you're ever going to jump off of a boat around here, what should you do first? Take a deep breath and hold your breath. And be ready to hold your breath even though your head's underwater and you're not going to, so that you defeat this gasp reflex, right, so that you don't drown. All right, so this is the respiratory chapter. So know some of these muscles for inspiration, know some for expiration. Know some of the basic properties of why air flows in and out of your lungs, because there are changes in the thoracic cavity, just the size changes, and what promotes, what's inside, what's a specialized structure inside the lung that promotes exchange. It's a special structure, it's called the alveolus, and remember you got 300 million of them, which is what, a huge surface area, that's half of a tennis court, right, for exchange. And when you say surface area, what should you think of? Doorway, yeah, doorway for exchange. And as the doorway gets bigger, the exchange is a lot faster too. Question?
What about the external
intercostals for breathing? Okay, so you got internal intercostals and external intercostals. The origins and insertions are a little bit different. The internal intercostals pull your rib cage down. So they're for expiration. Internals are for expiration. And the external intercostals elevate your rib cage. Those are for inspiration. So the external intercostals enlarge the thoracic cavity. That's for inspiration. So they're not named internal and external for inspiration and expiration. They're just named internal and external by their layers. Right? Internal is the deep one. External is the superficial layer. Right? So it's kind of opposite for inspiration and expiration. And don't forget, this is interesting. You got quiet breathing and forced breathing. And expiration for quiet breathing doesn't require muscles. It just requires elastic tissue to compress the lungs. Elastic tissue around the alveolus and the elastic properties of the diaphragm to get it to form more of a dome shape. Okay, so those are some things that aren't quite so intuitive. All right, what is the next chapter in your guide? Is it digestion? Yes. Digestive system. Okay, which is what we're covering in lab this week. All right, that's not too bad. All right, so components of the digestive system. All right, we've got, so here's some nice components of the digestive system. Right here, starting, I suppose, with your lips are real important, right? And teeth. Teeth are for chewing up big chunks of food into smaller pieces of food so you can swallow it. And what is the orbicularis oris good for? That's so that when you chew something, it doesn't come spitting out of your mouth, right? So that's important. So lips are important. The labiae are important. The muscle that closes them is important. The tongue is kind of important because it has taste receptors on it, and it also guides food into the pharynx, which is your throat. There are some glands that empty into the oral cavity and the pharynx, and these are salivary glands. We talked about the functions in lab. Salivary glands produce saliva, which is a lubricant, so that food can slide down the connecting tube between the oral cavity and the stomach. That's the esophagus. All right, the esophagus does have some smooth muscle, which by peristalsis moves food down into the stomach for you, but with saliva it makes it a whole lot easier. Okay, and then the throat is what we call the pharynx, esophagus, then we have the stomach. These are the primary organs for digestion and absorption. Here is the stomach, and then we have the small intestine. We got three divisions of the small intestine that we're going to look at. Then digesting food moves into the large intestine and then out your body. Some accessory structures, like here is the liver. It secretes a compound called bile, which aids in the digestion of lipids because oils and lipids don't dissolve in water. Bile is necessary to allow oils and lipids to dissolve in water. So think of bile as maybe like a detergent that helps emulsify lipids down. And then here's the pancreas. The pancreas is important because it produces digestive enzymes that get secreted into the small intestine for digestion of proteins and digestion of sugar molecules and digestion of lipids. Okay, what can we call an enzyme that digests a protein? This here's a little bit of some nomenclature. There are some specific names of enzymes that digest proteins, but a general name for an enzyme that digests a protein is called a protease. So you could take the name of the substrate, put ASE at the end of that name, and that describes what the substrate is. So protease will digest proteins. Okay, and a carbohydrase will digest carbohydrates like sugars, right? And a lipase is an enzyme that digests lipids or fats. Okay, there's some specific names that you might have to know in this chapter right here. Okay. All right, layers. Layers of the digestive tract. Very important to know layers. You got a pretty good diagram that shows the layers of the digestive tract right here. Okay, so one thing that kind of stands out is that I see a lot of red tissue, and red tissue is muscle, and in particular, smooth muscle. You don't have control of when smooth muscle contracts or when it relaxes. It's under autonomic control, or it could be kind of like the heart. It could be autorhythmic to a large extent as well. All right, so let's take a look at some of these layers. The most superficial layer is the serosa. All right, so here is the serosa. All right, it contains an epithelium and some connective tissue. It's a pretty thin layer, but it's pretty tough. And the epithelium, right, that is what the visceral peritoneum, same thing. And it's kind of slippery and slimy because these organs are moving around inside your abdominal and pelvic cavities all over the place. So that helps them slip and slide around. That's the serosa. That's the outermost layer. Then the next layer is the muscularis externa, next deepest layer. And I see in this part of the intestine there are two regions. Right, there's some longitudinal muscle. Right, that the long end of these smooth muscle cells aligns with the long axis of this particular tube, so we call that longitudinal. And then there are the next deepest layer is a circular band. So the long end of these smooth muscles kind of form a ring around the digestive tract. So the longitudinal layer makes the digestive system smaller, but the circular layer can act like a little valve, right, that can actually close, decrease the diameter of these blood vessels. The digestive tract. All right, the next deepest layer is the submucosa. The submucosa contains a lot of blood vessels and it contains glands for secreting digestive enzymes. And in here you can see a gland, and this is an exocrine gland because here's a little duct that carries its product into the lumen of the digestive system. Whether this is stomach or small intestine or large intestine really doesn't matter. Okay, so that's submucosa right here. And then the mucosa is the deepest layer. There is a muscle part to it as well, right? Just like the muscularis externa. There's a lamina propria that contains glands and lymphatic tissue. So here's a little malt, mucosa-associated lymphatic tissue that fights infection. This is in the lamina propria, and the lamina propria also has blood vessels. And then the deepest layer is the epithelium. And this epithelium is just a simple columnar epithelium in most parts of the digestive tract. And it has goblet cells as well that secrete what into the lumen? Yeah, it secretes mucus, right? And that mucus can form a nice barrier because there's digestive enzymes in the lumen right here that will digest the tube itself, and the mucus will then prevent that digestion from taking place. Mucus is also, in terms of the stomach, which is very acidic, mucus is also a nice barrier for acid. Acid can't get through that mucus lining on the stomach, and that helps preserve the stomach from ulcer formation. Okay, so those are the four main layers of the digestive tract. On the outside, that's the serosa, then the muscularis externa. Submucosa is between the muscularis and the mucosa right here. And the mucosa is what's important for absorption of nutrients and water and salts. Right, so these columnar cells are important for absorption. All right, so I see a highly vascular supply coming from the mesentery. Mesentery is a connective tissue that surrounds and forms the serosa of the digestive tube, right, and is loaded with blood vessels. You're going to see that for sure when we start doing the fetal pig dissection. And then I see a lot of yellow fibers right here. All right, and these yellow fibers represent the nervous system. And there are two main regions of the nervous system. You have a myenteric nerve plexus and the muscularis externa. It controls the contraction of these smooth muscles. Okay? And these nerves also go down and can stimulate the muscularis mucosa as well. And as a matter of fact, think of the central nervous system once. Let's get away from the digestive system for just a second. What are the two divisions of the central nervous system? Just a little review for Monday. It's what? It's the brain is part of the central nervous system, and what else? Spinal cord is the other part of the central nervous system. So what do you think? Does the spinal cord have a lot of neurons in it, would you guess? Yeah, it's just packed with neurons. Okay, well, here's an interesting fact. There's many more neurons in the digestive system, in the digestive tract, than there is in the spinal cord because it controls, right? All these neurons are very important. These different plexes are important for controlling how food transits the digestive system. And as a matter of fact, so we call this the myenteric nervous system that controls digestion. But for years and years before people knew what the digestive system was all about, because it contained so many nerves, people thought that this was actually the brain, which controlled the whole person, okay, which is a pretty strange thought. All right, so it's pretty important to control digestive processes and how food moves through the digestive system. And there are two main ways that food moves through the digestive system. There's a process called peristalsis. All right, peristalsis will move a bolus of food. So here's a bolus of food. Right, and it's contraction of the circular muscles right behind the bolus, and then that contraction moves as a wave down the digestive or the alimentary canal, forcing this bolus of food in one direction, say from mouth to anus, or from a proximal division of the esophagus down to the distal division of the esophagus near the stomach. So moving food in one direction, right, is what we call peristalsis. But what other kinds of muscles make up the alimentary canal? You have longitudinal muscles as well. So when circular muscles are coordinated with longitudinal muscles, then That's what we call segmentation. And segmentation contraction of the alimentary canal is a mixing function. So it mixes and churns, right, digesting material. So let's consider two boluses. Here is one, and here's another one that's distal to it. Segmentation then just means that, right, the next contraction that's going to take place, it's not going to sweep down as a wave, but it's going to jump from this location here to mid-segment right over here. And what is that going to do? It's going to mix half of the contents of the proximal compartment right here with half of the contents of the distal component and mix them together. Right? And then it's going to happen over and over and over again until finally, instead of having different kinds of material in different segments of the digestive tract, what's going to happen to the contents of each of these little divisions right here? It's going to be mixed together. It's going to be homogenized, right? So it's going to be homogeneous. So you can't tell that one compartment is different from another in terms of its contents. So that's what we call segmentation. And this is controlled by the myenteric nerve plexus within the stomach, whether it's going to be peristalsis or segmentation. All right, so that's two kinds of motions. Okay, stomach. Let me get a good picture of stomach. We look at lab. This is one figure that could be on a quiz for next time. So here is a stomach. And the function of the stomach, right, is not for absorption and digestion. Right? It's mostly because absorption and digestion take place in the small intestine, and it takes time in order for that process to happen. So the major function of the stomach is that it just stores food that we eat until the small intestine is available to do its job. All right, so the function of the stomach, if you're just going to remember two things, is storing and mixing. All right, so it's going to mix food that we eat with gastric juice, right, which is highly acidic. Right, and it also contains some proteases for initial digestion of proteins, right, and also secretes some other things for vitamin absorption, okay, that takes place in the small intestine. But the job of the stomach is primarily for storage and mixing. Okay, and what kind of motility is mixing? How many kinds of motility are you aware of now in the alimentary canal? There's two, and what are they? Peristalsis and segmentation, which is the kind that moves food along in one direction. That's peristalsis, and mixing is segmentation, right? So segmentation is a major function of the stomach, and you see it doesn't have just two layers in the muscularis externa. It has three layers. It has an additional layer of smooth muscle, right, that promotes segmentation. The stomach secretes intrinsic factor from the mucosa that aids in absorption of vitamin B12. And vitamin B12 is necessary for mitosis. It has another name. Anybody know another name? That's not so important for this class, but it's called cobalamin. And cobalamin has an element in there of cobalt. And so cobalt, you need a little bit of this vitamin in your diet, which contains cobalt, which is a pretty rare element, in order for mitosis to take place. And what good is mitosis? Mitosis does what? It replaces old and damaged cells, and it allows for growth. So growth is not such a really important function in our age group, but what about replacing old and damaged cells? What tissue is being replaced dramatically in your body all the time? Some cells only live for 120 days, and they got to be replaced. And those are red blood cells, right, in red bone marrow. So red bone marrow needs vitamin B12 so that you don't become anemic as a result of that. So that has to be in your diet. As a matter of fact, any vitamin, basically what a vitamin is a chemical compound that your body cannot synthesize on its own. You have to have a dietary source for it. Okay, otherwise you'll become anemic. So people that are on a liquid diet, like alcohol, guess what? They don't have vitamins in their diet, right? So what do they need? Exogenous vitamins. They need vitamin tablets, but usually they don't have those in their pocket. And when they unfortunately keel over because they're so anemic and end up in an emergency room, what's one of the first things they get? A shot of vitamin B12, okay, to help their red blood cell production, to help them get them back up on their feet once again. All right, when we mix gastric juice, okay, with food, we call that chyme. Gastric juice is hydrochloric acid with water and the protein, the enzyme that does an initial digestion of protein is called pepsin. All right, so that's what forms gastric juice. Okay, there are goblet cells that line the stomach. Parietal cells secrete hydrochloric acid and intrinsic factor, so you should probably know that. I'll look and see if we have a diagram of that. I think we have a diagram of that. Cheap cells, on the other hand, secrete a compound called pepsinogen and gastric lipase. What does gastric lipase do? It breaks down lipids, yeah? Okay, and pepsinogen. Here's a word I don't think we've talked about yet. Pepsinogen. Whenever you see a word with ogen as a suffix on the end of a word, it means that it is inactive. Is ready to go to work at a moment's notice, right? So the stomach produces pepsinogen in the wall of the stomach, and it is a protease. So pepsin breaks down protein. But if the stomach were to produce it in an active form inside the stomach, what would happen to the wall of the stomach? It would be digested away. So the stomach produces it in an inactive form that we call pepsinogen. Pepsinogen is secreted into the lumen of the stomach, where then it gets activated. Part of it gets broken off of this molecule, and it becomes pepsin, which is the active form, which then digests food inside the stomach instead of the stomach itself. All right, so where are some of these cells? Ooh, let's bring this up right here. Hopefully we have it right here. So here is the mucosa. Here is the simple columnar epithelium. So this is the lumen of the stomach right here. So this is the surface epithelium. And there are gastric pits that are lined with these cells right here. So there are chief cells and parietal cells that line this gastric pit. So here I can see some parietal cells, and way down here I can see some chief cells, and they secrete pepsin or pepsinogen and hydrochloric acid. And when pepsinogen mixes with hydrochloric acid, it becomes activated, it becomes an active form, it becomes pepsin. All right, there are also endocrine cells in the stomach that secrete regulatory hormones that can increase or decrease the rate of secretion and motility of the stomach and small intestine. That's what so endocrine is a cell that secretes a hormone that gets picked up by the blood that can travel to a distant target tissue to regulate its physiology. All right, so it's going to regulate the secretion of parietal cells and chief cells, increasing or decreasing the production of gastric juice. And they're stimulated when food enters the stomach, right? So that makes perfect sense. Okay, so here is a gastric pit that you can see. So when we do a fetal pig dissection, you could open up the stomach of a fetal pig and take a look at these gastric pits right here. Okay. The stomach secretes about 1.5 liters of gastric juice every day. So don't forget, a liter is a pretty big volume. I don't think anybody has a liter. Oh, maybe this is close to a liter. Maybe not quite. This is only about a half a liter, 600 mLs. Okay, so three of those things get emptied into your stomach every day just by the normal process of consuming food. And you would dehydrate very quickly if your body didn't resorb that. So just kind of keep that in the back of your mind. Also, salivary glands. Ooh, I have it up here someplace. Salivary glands secrete 500 milliliters a day. So one of these containers. So if you were to walk around all day long just spitting into this bottle, you would fill it up at the end of a day. All right, so that's 200 liters of fluid that you've lost already just by having food move through your oral cavity into your stomach. All right, and then as you can imagine, your stomach is in a pretty rough environment, right? Because the lumen is filled with pepsin, which is trying to digest it, and hydrochloric acid, which is trying to dissolve the stomach. So these cells that make up the stomach don't have a very long life. I don't know what happened to it. Was it? Let's see if I can get it back. Ah, right here. All right, so these cells have a very short life, so they're replaced very frequently as a result. So these things are at a very high rate of mitosis as a result. Let me move this over here. Ooh, now where's my word slide? Here it is. All right, so there are undifferentiated stem cells that renew the gastric epithelium every 3 to 6 days. So every week you have a new lining of your stomach right here, okay, because those cells just die because of the environment of the stomach. All right, so then that takes us to the small intestine. The function of the small intestine, if you're just going to remember two things, is digestion and absorption. Digestion and absorption of nutrients. So there are intestinal glands, just like there are gastric glands, that secrete about 2 liters of intestinal juice every day into the intestine. So now how much fluid have you lost from your cardiovascular system every day so far? So like 0.5 liter for saliva, 1.5 for gastric juice, 1.5. So, you know, we could say like 4 liters so far of fluid has been lost from your cardiovascular system, which could cause you to dehydrate. All right, so there are 3 divisions of the small intestine. Coming from the stomach is the duodenum, that's a proximal division. Then the middle division is the jejunum, and the distal is the ileum. And the ileum then empties into the large intestine. All right, so let's take a look at a cross-section of small intestine. Here's a pretty good example of small intestine right here. Okay, so what did we say the functions of the small intestine? Oh, I did it again. The functions of the, there it is, I'll leave it like that. The functions of the small intestine, digestion and absorption. What do you need for absorption? Surface area. What's a good way of thinking of surface area? Our doorway. So you need a large surface area to maximize absorption. All right, so let's look at some of the structures that maximize absorption. So think of what, like convolutions or folds. So here is a nice cross-section of small intestine. You can see the muscularis externa and the serosa out over here, right? And then here is the mucosa that lines the inside of the small intestine. And is this a flat, smooth tube, or what can you see? You can see a lot of circular folds that wrap around the inside of the small intestine. All right, so your intestine is maybe about 20 feet long, but in reality, if you stretch it out, don't really stretch it, but just stretch it enough to flatten out all of these circular folds. Sometimes we call these plicae circularis or circular pleats in Latin. Okay, the tube becomes much longer. It's a much longer tube, but it has those folds so that it fits inside your abdominal cavity. So here is a circular fold. Now, is a circular fold nice and smooth and flat? It has additional folds on it that we call villi. And these villi you can almost see with your naked eye. Not quite. You can't really see one of these finger-like projections, but if you look at the surface of the small intestine, and I guess I invite you to do that when we do a fetal pig dissection, you'll see that the surface is very velvety, right? You can almost see all of these little, almost microscopic folds on top of the circular folds of the smooth intestine. And so what could you do to understand how long the small intestine is? Not only straighten out the circular folds, but keep pulling it until you flatten out all of these villi as well. So now you have what? A really, really long tube that fits into a small space. All right, so these villi increase the surface area for absorption as well. The first thing are the circular folds. The second thing are these villi right here. Okay, but that's not it. There's more. If we look at a villus right here, we can see the simple columnar epithelium, which makes up the mucosa of a villus. And then if we take a microscope and zoom into this region right here, so here is just one of the columnar cells, and if we look at the apical surface, which is the surface facing the lumen, what do you see? More folds. And these folds are what we call microvilli. You need a good microscope to see these. So this cell really isn't, the width of this cell is not really from here to here in terms of absorption. What would you want to do to really measure what the width of this cell is? flatten out all of those microvilli, and the cell is what? Really tremendously long, okay, if you were to flatten it out. It has the same surface area, right, but if it's folded like that, then it just fits into a smaller space. So the three modifications of the small intestine that increase the doorway for exchange or absorption are these microscopic microvilli, and then the second one is the villus right here, these villi, and then the third thing is what? The circular fold. So if you flatten all of these things out, what is really the surface area for exchange? And I've got this on this slide right here. Okay. So when we speak of surface area scientifically, what should we be thinking of in everyday language? Think of it as a doorway, right? And the surface area of the small intestine, if it was just a simple flat tube without any folds inside of it, would be about 3.5 square feet, right? That's kind of interesting, but not really big. But all the folds that are mentioned above increases it to 2,200 square feet, all right? Or that would be the surface area of 47 feet times 47 feet, which is what? A lot bigger than this doorway right here, right? It's about 240 square meters. That's the floor area of an average two-level house. That's the surface area for exchange just within the small intestine. But that's important because what is the function of the small intestine? Is absorption, right? It has to have a big surface area to allow for exchange to absorb nutrients in our diet. All right, so if we look at this villus right here, right, what is the vascular element that allows for exchange? Yeah, capillaries, right? You got arteries and veins, and that they're not designed for exchange, only a capillary. So poking up in every villus right here is a capillary network, and we can see them. Here's the arteriolar supply, here's the venule supply, and then here are the capillaries. Capillaries are really good for absorbing sugars and amino acids. All right, and amino acids are the building blocks of proteins, but lipids are not absorbed by capillaries. Right, they're absorbed by this special little tube right here, which is running right through the center of this villus, and this is what we call a lacteal. And a lacteal really is a lymphatic capillary. So lipids get absorbed into a lacteal, which then carries it into your lymphatic system, your lymphatic vessels. Right, so lipid is absorbed in a villus right here, but by a totally different kind of vessel. It's a lymphatic vessel, not a circulatory system vessel. All right, so the other thing that this slide shows right here are some pits. Okay, we call these crypts, intestinal crypts, and there are cells that secrete hormones that control digestive processes, and there are also different kinds of glands that secrete digestive enzymes into the small intestine, and it also secretes compounds that can neutralize stomach acid, especially in the duodenum, because the acid contents from the stomach enter the small intestine right there at the duodenum. So bicarbonate would be a good example of a chemical compound that can neutralize stomach acid. So if these crypts right here don't secrete bicarbonate, then stomach acid can damage the small intestine and produce ulcers as well, right? Which will then damage these blood vessels and can cause a hemorrhage. And that hemorrhaging can be so bad that it could be lethal. All right, so those things are pretty important for regulating pH. All right, so I guess we're going to stop right here. Maybe I'll talk about some of those intestinal glands as a review, talk about immunity of the small intestine, and then move on to pancreas and liver a little bit. So we're almost done with this chapter two. Ooh, what's the next chapter? The next chapter, probably, so we talk about respiration, will be urinary system. Okay, sign-in sheet. Here's the sign-in sheet if you need the sign-in sheet for today. Let me turn some lights on.